free energy now.
Imagine a world in which each home has its own power generator that obtains its energy in such a way that no fuel has to be added. Imagine every vehicle being able to run without ever stopping for fuel. Imagine each appliance having its own power source that never has to be recharged. That is the world of the future. Join with us now as we track our progress towards such a world.
Welcome to Free Energy Now. This is your host, Sterling Allen. We have as our guest today Steve Beebe. He's a PhD from the University of Southampton. They've come up with a technology to harness the energy from environmental vibrations. You've probably seen this announced in the news. It was covered by a number of different energy sources. Steve, thanks for joining us.
No problem.
So what time are you there over in the UK?
It's just gone 8 in the evening.
Okay. So you've had your dinner, and I haven't had lunch yet.
Yeah, I've just had my dinner. Very nice to you, absolutely.
Well, tell us about this sugar cube-sized technology that could harness environmental energy, could be used for wireless devices such as medical implants, for example, would be a great application of this technology.
Yeah, basically, it's anywhere where there's sort of kinetic energy, typically in the form of vibrations, then there's the opportunity to sort of convert that movement, that kinetic energy, into electrical energy. And the device we've designed and developed is basically designed to harvest the energy from vibrations, typically at around 50 or 60 hertz. But like you say, you could, certainly researchers are working on versions which convert movement from the human body and convert that into electrical energy for powering sort of medical implants as well. So, yeah, that's certainly an option.
What kind of testing have you done on different vibration input?
Well, we've characterized this device for vibrations at around the 50 to 100 hertz region. We've measured vibrations in lots of different sort of applications, sort of air compressors, air conditioning units, and things like this, sort of typical representative applications involving machinery driven by, by the main sort of electricity. And with the mains electricity drive, you actually get the characteristic frequency of the mains. So in the US, you've got 60 hertz. In the UK, we've got 50 hertz. And you find that actually works its way through to the vibrations, the mechanical energy that you experience in the application. So we've sort of designed our device to coincide with those frequencies.
Is this a piezoelectric effect?
The device that we've worked on is actually electromagnetic, so it's very similar to traditional wire-wound coil with moving magnets. So there's nothing particularly novel about that. But within the actual Vibes project, this was developed under an EU-funded project called Vibes. There was a piezoelectric device developed as well. That's a truly micro-machine silicon device, so that's very, very small, very novel. And that's also been completed very recently.
Now, if I understand right from the blown-up picture that I've seen, you have a couple little, for lack of better ways to describe it, like a diving board on which there are some weights that go up and down with the vibration, which then are transmuted into, it's like you described, a magnet going through a coil that then generates electricity. Is that even close to what you have? Is that a...
Yeah, that's a pretty good description, absolutely. Basically, your cantilever, like you said, the diving board, is basically your spring element, and then you have the added mass, which in this case are very tiny little tungsten blocks. Then you have some rare earth magnets located on the end of the cantilever, and basically at its particular resonant frequency, the magnets move up and down relative to the stationary coil. And what you have is a very tightly controlled magnetic circuit there. It's been sort of optimized with various design tools. And that concentrates the magnetic flux through the coil, and the magnetic flux moves with the magnets and basically induces the voltage in the coil.
It's basically using very traditional electromagnetic principles, just miniaturizing it using...
Yeah, that's right. Basically, it's very cleverly engineered. The coils are just... wound from wire that's just 12 microns in diameter. So we get around 2,500 turns in a very small space. And the magnets are quite small as well. So everything's been miniaturized as much as we can do sensibly.
Now, price point, I understand you're still quite expensive, and so these are going to be niche applications such as medical situations where you don't want to have to keep on opening up some guy's chest to change the batteries.
Yeah, that's right. That's the sort of, I mean, that's one sort of application. This is more aligned at sort of condition monitoring on industrial plants and equipment. So, for example, monitoring the health of bearings for and machines and their components. So we're targeting sort of wireless sensors for the condition monitoring industry in particular.
Mm-hmm. Would you see a time when this could actually become, let's say, for example, you could put it in somebody's backpack to power a wireless cell phone, for example. Is that a practical application?
Oh, okay, yeah, this is always everyone that sort of picks up on the possibility of charging the mobile phone, which would be really nice. You have to be careful with human-powered applications. Humans typically characterized by very large amplitude movements, but at quite low frequency. So you'd have to re-engineer the device for a larger mass moving at a greater amplitude. So you'd have a larger generator as a result. But certainly it is feasible to generate power, certainly for humans. Whether you could power up a mobile phone, I think a mobile phone typically draws, including, say, 10 minutes talk time a day, I think it typically draws around 15 milliwatts, which is quite a large amount of power. And humans, you actually need quite a large sort of generator to actually generate that sort of power. People have done work with sort of piezoelectric insoles in shoes to develop energy, and so people are working on that for sure.
What about sticking these things along vibrating pipes in an industrial setting where you've got maybe water or other fluids going through pipes creating vibrations? Would it be practical to slap these on there and harness some of that vibration?
Absolutely. That's one of the prime application areas. We have a spin-off company at Southampton called Perpetuum Limited, and that's one of their prime sort of applications within the petrochemical industry. And actually what you find is that sort of vibrations from the pumps, etc., actually travel down the pipes as well. So it's not just the fluid flow, it's actually the mechanical vibrations from the pumps themselves. So, yes, there's plenty of vibrations in that sort of industrial application.
What kind of energy are we talking about coming off of there?
It's fundamentally linked to the size of the generator, so the amount of mass you have moving and how much it's able to move. So they're sort of guidelines. You want to let your mass move as far as possible and have as large a mass as possible within the given space constraints. For our sort of little device, which is sort of like the size of a sugar cube, we're getting 50-odd microwatts from vibration levels of sort of 60 milli-G. For a larger size devices like the Perpetuum device, then you can get tens of milliwatts if you shake them hard enough. So that's very, very useful amounts of power.
In terms of price point, where these can be turned into a printed circuit board and possibly mass produced, are you looking towards a mass production type of scenario where you could bring the price way down and slap a whole bunch of these on, you know, maybe hook them together in series? You know, they could come in a sheet, for example, that you could then apply to a pipe and then hook the electrodes up and pull electricity off a vibrating pipe in a energy or a cost effective way. Is this something you're looking at?
So certainly, if we find the right application, I mean, the VIVES project, unfortunately, has just come to an end, but we are looking to exploit the technology, most likely through Perpetuum. And if the right application is found, then we will basically need to re-engineer it a little bit for manufacture, but it's very well suited to sort of pick-and-play-style manufacturing. It's not a true micro-machined MEMS device, so we don't get the full-scale advantages of wafer, sort of silicon wafer production. But there's no reason why it can't be manufactured in a low-cost way with sort of pick-and-place technology. And, yeah, the cost should come down to, well, maybe less than $10 for one of these devices, or potentially a lot less than that, actually, thinking about it. Perpetuum's devices, which are a lot larger, they're targeted, I think, around $50 to $100.
So $50 or $10 per one of these sugar cube sized devices?
Yeah, I'm sort of guessing here, really. I'm not a manufacturing engineer, but that's the sort of price that would certainly be very feasible.
Yeah, I would think you'd need to go quite a bit lower than that before you could start competing with, say, solar, for example. Well, let me just give you context for the reason for my question.
Sure.
Here at the New Energy Congress, what we do is review a whole myriad of different energy-generating modalities, and we focus in on what we call free energy. And by free energy, we don't mean perpetual motion. We mean energy sources that are free for the taking. Solar, wind, geothermal, tide are all free energy sources. So you don't have to pay a penny for them. But the devices that harness that energy are anything but free. And the idea is to compare the different modalities and the efficiencies and the safety and the reliability of these different modalities and then compare them. And we have a top 100 energy technologies listing. And when I ran your technology by the New Energy Congress, a subset of them kind of screened some of these technologies and said, do you think this would be a contender? And the answer was no. It's interesting science, but it's not practical on such a level as to be something which could, be feasible on a large scale, which could make a dent on a global energy scale. The reason I'm asking about, if you were to mass produce this thing and use some of the circuitry, mass production infrastructure and whatnot, could it eventually get to the point where it would, with say, solar?
You sort of targeting sort of generating sort of large amounts of power then, sort of, is that your sort of your angle there with the question?
Well, yeah, I'm thinking about it is a niche application, but there are a lot of environmental vibrations that happen in our in the world. I could think of, for example, cars going down the road vibrating the road. You could think of a train passing over a bridge. It creates a lot of vibrations, and if you could bring the price point down low enough, you could actually do two things. Number one, you could harvest that vibration energy. Number two, you would actually mitigate the vibrations and reduce the noise, so you have a reduction of environmental noise pollution by harnessing that vibrational energy. You've got trees shaking in the wind. You've got from natural sources. So everything from man-made to natural vibrations are all over the place. You've got sound. In a city, you've got a lot of sound vibration. If you could put some mylar bags up and see that, you have a little device that starts wiggling when you've got the heavy noise going on in a big city, maybe you could harvest some of that and reduce the noise. I'm just kind of brainstorming here, but it seems like the potential applications are very diverse and very widespread.
Yes, you're correct. I mean, all these are very good suggestions. You have to design the generator for each sort of frequency and movement type. So, if you mention a tree and breathing in the wind sort of example, that's a sort of, again, a low frequency, high amplitude movement. So you design a sort of generator for that particular application. But yes, these are certainly all possibilities. Absolutely. I mean, I guess the reason I'm not familiar with the costing up of this sort of thing. I'm basically an academic, so not too familiar with that sort of thing. But given the right application you develop this for enough quantity, then I'm sure it could be engineered very cheaply. And certainly there's a lot of research going on for these men's scale devices, which have all the advantages of high number fabricated devices on each wafer, you know, all the advantages of semiconductor fabrication processes, which has the potential then to make very low-cost vibration energy harvesting devices.
When you say MEMS, M-E-M-S, what does that stand for?
That stands for micro-electromechanical systems. So you're using a technology very similar to that used to make integrated circuits, to actually make micro-mechanical structures. There's a lot of interest in developing these vibration energy harvesting devices using this MEMS technology.
Mm-hmm.
And then you make thousands of devices on each wafer, and you bring the cost right down.
So I guess to maybe repeat the question, obviously there are going to be some niche applications where the price is not going to be nearly a consideration as much as the practicality and the utility is going to be, such as we described the ability to perpetually power a medical implant device that where you don't want to have to keep opening up, you don't want to have wires protruding out of a subject.
Hmm.
And if you can power the device from the natural vibrations that the human is, whether it's the bloodstream going by or whether it's the movement of the arm or the movement of the patient, you know, if you can harvest that, that'd be very practical. And the price is not going to be, you know, you can pay a higher price because of the advantages that come. But that's a very high niche situation. And the other end of the spectrum that we've been describing, the myriad of applications from the environmental and man-made vibrations that we have, would you foresee a day when the price could come down where that could actually... We know it's possible. The question is practical. Is it practical? Could you see an envision of time 5, 10, 15 years out, and how far out do you think we are from seeing something practical along those lines?
I think for a large-scale deployment, I think we're a fair way away from that. I think you'd really have to develop this MEMS sort of technology fully and get very high performance devices out for that sort of large-scale deployment. I think at the moment it is a sort of niche application in certain high-value application areas such as medical or other applications in sort of condition monitoring where the ability to place your sensors in locations that prevent you from using wires or solar cells, for example, in vibration energy harvesting is really the only choice. So you get an advantage, for example, in embedding your condition monitoring sensors inside a gearbox. And you can't get into that gearbox to change batteries. You don't want wires coming out of it. And you obviously can't use a solar cell in that environment either. So that's the sort of application area, which is, again is another niche application, but that's really what we would target at the moment. Large-scale deployments, I think they're a long way off.
Mm-hmm. On these niche applications that you're describing, it would seem that the vibration frequency is going to be quite different from one to another. Does that mean you're going to have to engineer per application or kind of have on your shelf you'd have... You know, this device here covers frequencies from 0 to, you know, from 60 to 100 hertz. This shelf here is for 100 to 120 hertz or whatever. So you'd have it broken down into frequencies, et cetera. How practical will it be to have a bunch of these made, or are you going to have to hand, or not hand make them, but one-off them per application?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and that's again one of the sort of things to be aware of with the technology. You get your mechanical advantage by having the device tuned to the application frequency, but the more finely tuned it is, then the more power you get out. But the downside to that is that if the frequency in the application environment changes a little bit, then your power starts to drop off. So what you actually want from a device is you actually want a reasonable level of power but a large bandwidth. So you want to get that power over a decent frequency range so that you can accommodate any likely frequency shifts in the application environment. What we find is that certainly for equipment powered off the mains, there is a very strong link to the mains frequency and the vibrations you experience in the equipment. What Perpetuum do is they offer their generators basically at around 50 or 100 hertz and 60 and 120 hertz. And that actually does cover quite a wide range of equipment. And those basically have a bandwidth of up to, say, I think it's around 4 or 5 hertz. So that's a pretty, that's probably about as good as it gets at the moment. We are researching ways of changing the frequency automatically of the generator. So you can have mechanisms that tune the frequency. And you can achieve quite large changes of frequency. So say, for example, if a device is at 100 hertz, you can tune that plus or minus 50 hertz with various mechanical means. But these all consume power themselves. And it's very important that obviously your tuning mechanism doesn't consume more power than you're actually getting from benefit from being at resonance. And again, you end up duty cycling your tuning mechanism to make sure you actually have a net power gain. But it's an area of research that we're working on at the moment, and it's got to be cracked, really, before you can ever get sort of these large-scale deployments that you're hinting at.
Are you in the stage yet of actually going to market, of providing these to customers, or are you in a beta testing stage, or are you still deep in R&D?
I guess we're at a stage now where it could be developed for manufacture, but what we need is basically the customer to come along with the application that it's well suited to, basically, and then to make it worth the while for Perpetuum to develop it, or one of the consortium of the research team working on it. So somebody, you know, we could develop it, but we need that application, basically.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, just in terms of the logistics of going into a commercial application where you are an academic institution, is that something that your university is geared to do, to open up a business application, or do you hand it off to somebody else to take it from there?
Yeah, I mean, this company, Perpetuum, is a university spin-out. And it was based upon this vibration energy harvesting technology, albeit on a larger scale. But yes, that would be the natural vehicle which we'd exploit the technology through. And they're very interested in exploiting the technology if the right application comes along. I mean, their existing generators are sort of the size of a coffee cup, and they're obviously applied in applications where there are no space constraints. And the technology we've developed at the university is obviously much, much smaller. And that opens up new possibilities and new application areas. But Perpetuum would be the obvious vehicle for us to develop the technology further.
Right now, the website that I have for you is looks like a university website.
The Vibe, yes, absolutely. Site. Yes. Yep.
Are you going to get a commercial website anytime soon?
Are you looking at the Vibes project website? Or Perpetuum have a very good website. That's perpetuum.com. My personal
What's
website
the name
is
of the domain
based
again?
At the university.
Could you tell me the name of that domain again?
Perpetuum.com, P-E-R-P-E-T-U-U-M.
You're spelling just a little bit too fast. It's not jiving with me. Could you...
Sorry, okay. P-E-R-P-E-T-U-U-M.
I guess our connections of P-E-R, and then what comes after R?
P.
P as in Paul?
Yep. E-T-U-U-M.
Perpetuum.
That's it.
Okay. P-E-R-P-E-T-U-U-M.
.com, yeah, that's...
So that's kind of funny for a university to use that name with all the baggage of perpetual motion.
Well, I see what you're saying, but you obviously got to take it with a bit of pinch of salt. It's not alluding to perpetual motion, but it is a perpetual, in theory, a perpetual energy source. I mean, their devices are engineered to sort of last for around 10 years, which is, for this sort of deployment that's envisaged is perfectly sufficient, obviously, for the lifetime of most machines, and certainly far superior to a battery.
Uh-huh. So this, as I go to their website, it looks like a highly professional global leader in vibration energy harvesting.
Absolutely. Yes, they have the top performing generator that you can get currently commercially available.
Now, is that, are they working with you, or is this a competitor?
No, I'm a founder of the company, so along with three of my colleagues from the university, so we work very closely with them.
Okay. Yeah, I have.
And the university, this is a typical way that the university exploits research development. So, you know, we spin out the company, we get some venture capital funding, and develop the technology commercially.
Yeah, I guess I get a sense of. I find it really quite humorous, as I mentioned, that you would have picked such a name coming from an academic background, and which is really satisfying for me because, you know, I also have some academic background in another field in the biological sciences, and, you know, the whole field of, quote, free energy gets a real bad rub saying, well, you can't get energy out of nothing, but I'd say we're not saying that's what we're doing. Like this, with this technology recently over in London, the Orbo technology, where they were had this magnet motor technology that they were going to be demonstrating to the world, and it ended up being a dud demonstration. But they kept saying, no, we don't believe this is a perpetual motion. It's not violating the second law of thermodynamics. Just because you can't see where the energy is coming from doesn't mean it's not coming from somewhere that we don't yet fully understand. I don't know how many times they said that, but everyone keeps thinking perpetual motion. You guys are breaking the laws of physics. No, we're just discovering a new phenomena. You know, knock yourself out figuring out what it is, but, you know,
yeah.
Why can't you have some imagination that energy could be coming from zero-point energy or, you know, whatever it is, it's coming from somewhere. We don't know where, but it's coming from somewhere, and yet you, even today I read a story in the BBS News where they even quoted them as making that point, and yet they still concluded the article as if these guys are heretics.
Yes, I understand where you're coming from. To be honest, you're the first person to actually sort of pick up on the link with perpetual motion or anything like that. Nobody's ever really noticed that in the name before, but it is fairly obvious, and the intention was there. But it's not. It's tongue in cheek. It's not. It's obviously not perpetual motion. It's a parasitic energy source. You know, like you say, you're scavenging energy from that's already there in the environment, and there's nothing more to it than that.
Right. Well, what if somebody were to come to you today? You know, go to your website here, and say, I want one of these things. What kind of lead time are we talking about to where they would walk away with product?
Well, if you just want it in small quantities, you know, we've got several of the devices now. It takes, it would have to be engineered again for manufacture for that to be done. I would think that would take 2 or 3 months to do the re-engineer it for manufacture. No longer than that. It's nothing too major.
Mm-hmm. And how many people are involved in the company at this point?
In Perpetuum, they've got a team of about a dozen working on it.
Mm-hmm. Do you have investors, or how are you getting funded?
Yes, it's funded by venture capital. So the university has very close links with two groups of venture capitalist funders who basically get first call on any research that comes out of the university. And it's a very sort of set, organized route to spinning the company out, valuing the company at each stage, etc. So, and I think the Perpetuum have been through two rounds of venture capital funding, and that's what we've been funding, each time the fundings came from with basically the same group of venture capitalists. We're very happy with the technology and the way the company is progressing. And we're just looking for a third round of funding now.
When technology is born from an academic situation, and those in academia stay involved even to the commercial end of things, what happens to their academic involvement? Do they just par back, Or do they jump ship, or, you know, what's the story there?
Yeah, it's a very case by case basis. I think the preferred route at Southampton is that the academics certainly help out a lot to start with, but one of the first positions that they'll appoint is a CEO to actually take the company forward, and also a chief technology officer. And I think Perpetuum's a pretty classical case where they've been going for now 3 years, and our involvement is certainly a lot less than it was. They don't encourage the academics to get involved in running the company, just helping out with the technology. But I think that's very sensible, because as academics we have to recognise our strengths in the science, in the technology. We're not really clued up for running a company and growing it as fast as possible, etc. So I think that's a very sensible model that they run. So basically now, I mean, my academic career is pretty much as it was 3 or 4 years ago. It hasn't really changed my academic career at all.
Mm-hmm. And what is your professor of?
I've got a very strange, peculiar English title, which is a reader, which is sort of kind of in between. I think you've got an associate professor and professor, a reader, sort of somewhere in between those. And I'm a reader of microsystems, so, which is MEMS, basically. It's the European terminology for MEMS. So I do a lot of work with silicon devices, silicon sensors, etc. And this was the original intention for this vibration energy harvesting device, was for it to be made in silicon. But this version, it actually works a lot better if you make it just a little bit larger using traditional technologies.
I would think that would, your student audience would largely be graduate students, that there wouldn't be much place in an undergraduate program for classes along those lines.
No, you're right. The actual lecturing that I do that follows my research is to master's students. I obviously do some lecturing to undergraduates as well, but that's that's on much more standard electronics, so and electromechanical design and things like that.
Do you have students involved in the project of taking it to market, or do they just stay with the academic as well?
We haven't had any students who've gone to work for Perpetuum directly, but we have certainly had students do summer projects and group projects on the technology. And certainly at the master's level, the students are very, very capable and able to do very good research over a 3-month period that yields some very, very good results. And certainly the demonstrator and the device that's hit the press was quite heavily developed, actually, with the help of students. They designed the power conditioning circuit for that device, and also some of the communication side as well, and the energy management. So, yes, students actually play quite a good role in the developing this sort of technology.
The prototype that we see that was featured in the news stories, how many have you built, and how many applications have you tried at this point?
We've got about half a dozen working devices, and they're basically just scattered around the university. So we've got one on an air compressor, and we've got another couple on two different air conditioning units, one in the workshop, and one is actually a portable air conditioning unit just in someone's office. And it's basically just they're transmitting acceleration information to a receiver so that you can just look at the vibration levels coming off the equipment. And whilst in actual fact that, you know, in that particular application it's not actually doing anything meaningful, it does demonstrate that the technology is capable of transmitting and measuring acceleration data, which in a real application would be very useful for monitoring the health of the machine.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the story that I read, there was mentioned the idea of medical implants. Have you done any prototyping there?
No, I know. Perpetuum have a project where they're developing a device to augment the power supply for a pacemaker. I'm not actually involved in that particular project, but certainly around the world there are quite a few researchers working on human-powered devices for powering sort of wearable electronics and implanted medical devices. And it's quite an important area of research within sort of energy harvesting for, community.
Mm-hmm.
You're probably familiar with the kinetic watch as well, you know, the sort of self-powered watch, which is a sort of example of, you know, something that everyone's familiar with. And that does highlight the sort of possibilities of the technology and also its limitations in that application, because that typically only generates, you know, maybe 1 to 5 microwatts, depending on how much you're moving. So it's low power levels from a sort of that sort of size device.
Now, this is going to be a little off the wall, but when we talk about implants and generating electricity via kinetic motion of the body, wondering, the body is very electrical on a number of different levels. You have millivoltage potentials between extremities of limbs and the torso, and from the where the limbs meet the torso to the center of the body, there are potentials. We have voltage gains or voltage drops. And then you also have intracellular potentials across the membranes, and you have potentials across, you know, your nervous transmission of signal pulses is through an electrical process as well. And just wondering if that area is of any interest, that you track it at all for actually using the innate electrical properties of the body to actually, you know, like plugging the electrodes into the body itself to generate a potential in a current.
I'm certainly aware that people pick up those signals and use them in sort of medical devices, maybe moving prosthetic limbs and things like that. But I hadn't thought about the opportunity of maybe harvesting the signal and the stimulus and using that as an energy source. I'm not familiar enough really to gauge how feasible that would be. I imagine that it's actually very, very low levels of power, very low levels of charge. And reasonably difficult to actually harvest as well. I think you have to be very careful with anything that's human-powered or human-based, that it doesn't actually affect the human body in any way. And I think a good example of that is the possibility of generating energy from the temperature gradient from the human skin. So you can use thermoelectrics, for example, to generate electricity. Use a thermocouple device. And what you find there is actually the human body, actually the blood supply to the area where you've got your thermoelectric device actually diminishes, because the body recognizes that you're actually drawing heat away from the body. And it's like a self-defense mechanism. It actually draws the blood away from that part of the skin. And therefore your thermoelectric device becomes much less efficient. I don't know if that sort of thing would work, if would happen again if you're trying to harvest energy from a sort of cellular level. I'm not familiar enough to judge that.
Mm. Yeah, it would be an interesting avenue.
Absolutely, it certainly would be, yeah. And the signals are perfectly detectable, so there is obviously energy there, like you suggest.
In terms of scaling this thing up for production and building production prototypes, you were talking about getting your third round of funding. Is that your next step, is to go there?
Essentially, yeah. For Perpetuum, they're looking for the third round of funding now, which should see them through to profitability. And as part of that, I'm sure that given a suitable opportunity, we develop these smaller scale devices and develop them for manufacture, absolutely.
How long have you been working on this?
Well, that's it's quite a long time now. We actually wrote our first research proposal on the subject of vibration energy harvesting in 1995, and we had our first PhD student start in 1998, I believe. So since then, so it's a fair time now. We've been working on it, and this is sort of like the pinnacle we've reached at the moment, the Vibes project, and it's a really good outcome. It's certainly it's the best performing device of its size, and given sort of like the acceleration levels and the frequency it's designed to operate at, it's the best device out there so far. So we're very pleased with the results.
Good. I have seen a few of these come along, including people who are talking about harvesting, for example, road traffic, people coming off ramps and decelerating and putting devices underneath the road to harvest that type of thing. But those are often piezoelectric based types of things rather than the vibrational effect. I guess I hadn't realized that your claim that this is the best performing device of its size. Do you know of devices that are, since this is your industry of MEMS, devices quite a bit smaller than this?
Yes, certainly. Within the Vibes project, we developed a piezoelectric device which is it's 2 cubic millimeters in size. So it's 2 millimeters by 2 millimeters by 0.5 millimeter thick. And that's it's a very similar looking structure. It's a cantilever with a mass at the end, but instead of an electromagnetic circuit, it's basically got a thin layer of piezoelectric material at the root of the cantilever beam. And as the beam moves up and down, obviously the piezoelectric gets deformed, and you have electrical energy generated. And there's several examples actually around the world of similar sorts of devices. It's a sort of fairly straightforward way of designing your generator, and piezoelectrics are a fairly obvious way of actually transducing the mechanical energy into electrical. So, and with the MEMS technology, yeah, you can get down. I think the smallest is around 0.5 cubic millimeter that's been published in the literature. But unfortunately, as you go smaller in size, then the resonant frequency of the generator tends to increase. The smallest device has got a resonant frequency over 13 kilohertz, which isn't particularly useful. So there's no particular applications that drive that sort of device. So it's definitely a target is to keep the frequency low.
What about regions that are, devices that are larger, let's say 2 or 3 times larger than what you have?
Yeah, the larger you make it, then the more mass you have moving at potentially a larger amplitude, and basically the more energy you have available. So I think it becomes easier to make these devices as well, make them more efficient the larger they are. So that's certainly the sort of thing we see with the devices that Perpetua make. They're capable of generating milliwatts of power last for many years in applications. So it's not so challenging to make the devices larger. It's more challenging to make them smaller and still produce worthwhile amounts of power at useful frequency ranges.
At what point would the vibrational energy, is there a crossover between it's more practical to use the vibrational energy as opposed to, let's say you've got a wind turbine, you've got wind moving along, and you put a turbine up there and you get rotational energy versus vibrational energy. Have you looked or studied that question much in terms of, obviously on a very small scale, the vibrational energy makes sense, but as you start getting larger, the turbine approach would seem to make more sense. Let's just take the scenario of a moving body of water. You've got a river or a bloodstream, and you've got fluid going along, and obviously putting some kind of turbine up into that fluid to turn that into rotational energy makes sense. But it would also make sense to put something up there that gets vibration going, where the harvest of the vibrations. At what point does it make more sense to go turbine, and at what point does it make more sense to go vibration?
Yeah, that's a good question. Certainly, we did actually do a design study on a sort of self-powered ocean buoy that was driven by the wave motion, and it's a self-contained buoy. So essentially, you're harvesting the vibrations, the vertical motion of the buoy, and it is actually it's quite difficult to get Well, we were designing for something around 10 watts of power from a buoy, but you did need a very large mass moving actually 2 or 3 meters to actually get that sort of level of energy out. And the sort of engineering challenges and the practicalities of that sort of thing mean that I think that sort of scale, a few watts, it's probably better to use a turbine sort of something that's conventionally engineered and use a rotational sort of approach to actually generate the electricity rather than a linear vibration. So you can certainly get lots of advantages using a sort of conventional alternator with a rotating mechanism rather than relying on linear vibrations.
What about back EMF and heat? Are you seeing those as being an issue with your design?
Well, the power levels of these designs are so small that it's not an issue, no. So I think a few milliwatts of power, you don't actually see much in terms of heat. Certainly we try to keep the coil resistance as low as possible, basically from a point of view of efficient coupling of the energy from the generator to the electronics. And again, that benefits the back EMF and heat as well. You do all the usual tricks in transformer design to sort of minimize eddy currents as well if you've got an electromagnetic generator again, and that keeps the heat down. But again, the powers are basically low at the moment, a few milliwatts. Heat really isn't an issue at this stage.
Would you ever see the harvesting of sound and noise as being, and would that be a spin-off or a similar related field to what you're doing, or is that far enough away from what you're doing? Would you see that as ever being practical?
I think sound energy is quite low level. I mean, it's a microphone is essentially a device which, you know, converts the sound energy into electrical energy, and but the amount of power you're getting off a microphone is pretty small. You know, if you had a reliable frequency of sound energy and you tuned your microphone to harvest that particular frequency, then possibly, yeah, absolutely, it could be possible. But again, how much energy you'd get out from what levels of sound you'd need, I'd be hesitant to say that it would be particularly feasible.
So that's what a microphone does, is it converts vibrational sound into electrical. But the amount of energy you're saying is very small. So for purposes of a microphone, yes, it's something that we do all the time. But for purposes of energy generation, for the amount of equipment required, is not a feasible scenario.
Well, ultimately, it would depend upon the application you're trying to harvest the energy from and what the form of the form of the sound energy is. If you have a reliable sort of sound energy, or a reliable frequency, for example, then I guess it would be feasible then to sort of design your microphone to basically concentrate on that frequency and to sort of, again, resonate at that particular frequency and efficiently generate as much energy as possible. You know, your conventional microphone is designed to have a very flat frequency response, so it doesn't resonate. You know, it's exactly what you don't want. But with these sort of energy harvesting devices, you tend to get a lot of a mechanical advantage by actually operating them at resonance. And I imagine that's the sort of thing you'd have to do for sound energy as well.
Well, if you envision in industry, for example, you've got these machines that are running all day long at the same speed, doing the same task continuously, they would have a very fixed mark noise signature, and it would seem like it would be desirable to harvest that for two reasons. Number one, it would reduce the noise level. Number two, you would have energy generated where, you know, it's just going to waste now. So it would be kind of a waste to energy, a genre of energy. Would you see something like that ever being plausible?
I mean, that's a good scenario you've described there, where you have got a sort of reliable, repeatable sound, effectively, from an industrial environment. Then potentially, yes. I guess it comes down to at what point you've got to capture the sound. I guess you want a reasonable surface area to capture as much sound energy as possible. And at what point does the infrastructure become such that you might as well just put a wire there and supply power from an external power source? So, but I guess the scenario you're describing is one potential for sound energy. Yeah.
Mm. Do you know if there's a name for such an approach? You were describing MEMS as being the microelectric. I think that's what you called it.
Microelectromechanical systems.
Yeah. Would that fall under as a subset of MEMS?
Potentially, yes. I mean, certainly microphones can be made using MEMS technology. So your hearing aid microphones are all little micro machine silicon devices. So, yes, I mean, absolutely. Yeah, it's one potential way of doing it, for sure.
Here as we come to the end of our time, we got about 4 or 5 minutes before we need to wrap up here. Is there an area that we've not talked about that you maybe would like to bring up?
Well, I'd like, just like to say, obviously, the work that we've publicized has certainly been the result of a very successful collaboration. The project was from within Europe, and the project was funded by the European Union. And it's a consortium of 10 companies, including Philips and their recent spun-out semiconductor manufacturer NXP, our colleagues in Tyndall in Ireland, at University of Cork, Ireland, and several French institutions, TEMA, CNRS, and Metrovib as well, MEMSCAF, another French company. And it's been a very, very successful collaboration of the partners to develop both the electromagnetic device and a piezoelectric device. And the project's been a very good example of European cooperation between the countries and the member states and the organizations within it to successfully develop and move technology forward. And it's been a very good project to work on, a really good experience as well. So I've really enjoyed the work, and it's nice to be involved in a successful project like this.
Very good. Now, what's in this whole scenario of MEMS, maybe you can give us an idea of your position in that constellation, so to speak.
Well, within the MEMS field, as a typical academic, we started off researching sort of devices which are now commonplace. So, 10, 15 years ago, we were working on pressure sensors, for example, and now these are, really mass-produced very widely by big companies using MEMS technology. So now from a research field, we're sort of looking at various bio-MEMS devices, looking at spell manipulation and things like this. So lots of novel sorts of niche areas within MEMS. And basically industry have developed a lot of these sort of obvious applications, if you like. And the technology is very well established now. So, for example, if you have an accident in the car and your airbag is activated, that's very likely to be a MEMS accelerometer, so a tiny little micro-machine silicon acceleration sensor which detects the crash and actually sets off the airbag. And that's been developed over many years now and is obviously in wide-scale use, and it can be produced very cheaply using MEMS technology. So it's a very successful technology now.
Is MEMS involved in GPS at all?
That's a good question. I don't know, actually. I don't think so, particularly, no.
I'm not entirely sure.
Well, certainly there's lots of navigation devices, like gyroscopes, for example, which can be made using MEMS technology. But I don't think it's involved in actual GPS.
All right, well, I appreciate you giving us this information. Again, this is the Free Energy Now show. We've been talking to Steve Beebe, PhD from University of Virginia.
Thank you. You've been listening to Free Energy Now, brought to you by PES, Pure Energy Systems. You may access past archives and upcoming show info at freeenergynow.net and join us for our daily news at freeenergynews.com. We invite you to see our directory of energy technologies at peswiki.com. That's peswiki.com. PES, the Pure Energy Systems Information Network.